The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, I went to the AAAS and all I brought back was this lousy interview. No, not really. It's great. It's all about this sound. A former government advisor explains his new approach to drugs classification.
So we took those 16 variables and we took 20 drugs and we scored each drug on those variables.
We also look at why the US won't be adopting the Netherlands coffee shop culture anytime soon.
They've had to now bring in medicinal cannabis use. In a way, it's been brought in to allow people to have access to cannabis without going to prison.
We visit a huge diamond.
Well, it's not something you're going to go and buy your wife because you feel bad, you know, because you went to a football match and then you forgot her birthday.
Look at some incredible scientific images.
These are actually the colours which are true to life, so they exist on the body of the wasp.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Now, I'm a little jet-lagged from the whistle-stop tour of Washington, D.C. for the AAAS meeting. Now, last week, we might have promised you a special program from the world's biggest science festival. However, if you go to our website and see the dozens of stories sitting there from the AAAS this year, you'll probably have worked out that it was quite hard to actually write those stories and record audio at the same time, even in this multimedia lifestyle we all live. So instead, we're going to just talk about the stories here. With me is the Guardian science correspondent.
Hold on. So you're saying you were too busy?
Ian Sample.
You were too busy last week in Washington, D.C. Yes, of course I'm recording this. Okay. Now, if I may interject, there's in my hand I've got a sheet of paper with your Twitter feed on.
Now, which is mainly automatic, by the way, I have
really?
You know.
Well,
I don't do any of it.
This is automatic. Okay, well, I just wanted to point out a few tweets. You were very busy, remember? So it starts off your little trip to the AAAS. My hotel's a few blocks from the White House. I'm basically in the West Wing. Now to find some reports. Got to meet Josh later. then it goes on. Then there are several tweets about cake policy and things like that. The pastry theme continues. You had a meeting with Obama's pastry chef. Is that right?
He was around, yeah.
In the White House. Okay, then we move on. This is when you're supposed to be recording interviews, remember. Plan is now 7:30 p.m. in the Grand Hyatt. Just got to do some work beforehand. So there you go. You're obviously rushing your work to get to the bar. And then this is when you could have been doing the really important stuff. Ended up singing Total Eclipse of the Heart on stage in a bar in Adams Morgan. We can both retire happy, lives fulfilled. You were pretty busy then, were you?
Well, you know.
It must be tough going out there, having to do all that,
hanging out. When you see all that science face up, you need a bit of chill time.
21st of February, 6:58 a.m. Also heard this evening, Dee Derbyshire singing Under My Skin by Old Blue Eyes. Such heart, such heart.
I was drunk. What do you want?
Anyway, I'm going to get behind the desk. So you were too busy anyway to get me any interviews.
Anyway, Ian Samples here, the Guardian science correspondent.
Hi, Alok.
You normally go to the AAAS and, you know, you produce reams of stuff. How hard is it to also do a podcast at the same time?
It can be really tough. And actually, on my last trip to the States, I actually forgot the recording equipment, so which was a blessing in many ways, apart
so
from
for 2 years
branding,
in a row,
I didn't even have
this.
To even think about recording anything.
Anyway, let's go and talk about these stories now. The first one.
I was really interested in three of these stories. The one I picked out first was your story about how being bilingual might delay Alzheimer's disease and boost the brain power of people. That sounds a really interesting thing. And this isn't just that people who are able to speak two languages just have better brains, is it? It's actually the learning of those languages and the practicing of those two languages is itself having an effect.
So the study that was presented, it was published in a journal recently. So scientists at York University, not the one in England, but the one in Toronto, and what they did was to take 102 people who were bilingual and 109 monolingual people. All these people had probable Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, they were suspected of cognitive decline in that respect. And they just looked at what age the first symptoms had appeared. And they found that controlling for all sorts of other factors, that bilingual patients were diagnosed 4.3 years later on average and reported the onset of symptoms about 5 years later. So, you know, if you want to just do a top line thing, if you're bilingual, and by that, you know, properly bilingual, as in you can speak two languages naturally, almost natively, then it seems to have an effect where your first symptoms of Alzheimer's appear about 5 years later. Now, this is pilot, early study stuff. You know, it's not to say that this is some universal thing necessarily, but it's an interesting study.
What I really liked about one of the aspects of your story was you talked about this effect whereby bilingual people, sometimes when they're speaking to others who have the same two languages, they will not stick to one language, but they will actually choose the phrase from whichever language expresses their thoughts best. And I've experienced this in a research lab when I first moved to London. One of the guys I was working alongside was bilingual, and I'd hear him on the phone to his sister or his parents, and he'd be talking away in English, and then he would slip into another language, come back. And it was really interesting. Every now and again, you would just hear bits and bobs, and the language was, he was using two languages at once, essentially. And what's nice about that is it almost gives you this much broader landscape of language rather than just having one like English or any other. So you can imagine that there is just far more going on mentally and cognitively to be able to do that. And I like what the researcher said about how this almost gives you more cognitive reserve so that when Alzheimer's comes along, you just have more to deal with it. You can suffer you can suffer some decline without it initially impinging on your behaviour.
Essentially, what the session came to conclusion of was that there's lots and lots of benefits of having many languages. It's good for you in all sorts of ways, which kind of makes sense. I mean, it kind of makes sense that if you're speaking lots of different languages and using your brain in all these different ways, that your brain will be fitter, essentially.
How many languages do you speak?
Well, maybe 0.9. Anyone who's listened to this, I can't speak English very well. And the other language is I can say hello and can have a beer.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
Let's move on.
We've written a lot about fish stocks going down over the years, and it's always a pretty depressing story, but you have probably the most robust study on sort of the marine ecosystem and fish stocks out of the AAAS. Take me through that story, and it certainly sounds as to be fair, as often with these stories, we're being encouraged to eat what might seem less appetizing things from the sea.
Yeah, quite. This is surprising for two reasons, this story. One is that it's a genuine news story from the AAAS, which, you know.
Ouch.
Which is new. It's a real study. I mean, we can talk about the fact that AAAS isn't the place where people's scientists present new data anymore. Might have been 100 years ago, but not anymore. Anyway, but let's not go into that. But this one generally was new data. This is a bunch of scientists from the University of British Columbia Fisheries Center, and they had coordinated a huge international project from where they had data from 200 sort of bits of the ocean around the world, the bits of the ocean that had they covered all fish populations, essentially.
200 bits of the ocean.
Areas, let's say.
Stretches.
The bits is what came to my head. What I meant was areas of the ocean. Clearly, I've got no cognitive improvement from my languages. These guys had developed a method of counting not only the big fish, they count the small fish too. And it's a robust method which allows you to track fish populations in that particular part of the sea over a long period of time. And so they collated all this data, and what they found was two things. One, they confirmed that the big top predator fish, cod, tuna, groupers, etc., they've declined by two-thirds in the past 100 years, and that half that decline's happened in the past 40 years. I mean, it's just a precipitous thing, mainly because of overfishing, and it's a familiar story, this one. However, they also found that the total stock of the world's what they call forage fish, such as sardines, anchovy, capelin, these things have doubled in the past century. Now, these are fish that are normally eaten by the top predators, and it kind of makes sense. If the top predators aren't there, these other fish will bloom. And there's lots of them in the oceans. And so these guys are saying, you know, there are plenty of fish to eat in the sea. And don't worry about that, but just shift yourself away from salmon and tuna and these things. Eat some more sardines, eat some more mackerel, eat those sorts of things.
I was going to say, what are our options then? What's your favourite forager fish? I mean, I'm looking at the ones I can see so far. They're sort of basically my top list of fish I don't like.
What's the sardines and anchovies?
Well, anchovies are essentially swimming salt. sardines are mostly bone and eyes.
Mackerel's delicious.
Mackerel is delicious.
Very,
quite
very
strong.
Nice fish. You have to cook it properly, though, because even though it looks delicious as soon as you get it out of the ocean, it's not that you do any mackerel fishing, maybe, but
I have done.
They're full of parasites, usually. So you've got to cook it properly. But they're delicious fish. But the point is of this, that you know, if we can eat those fish for a while, that you might give the top predators time to regroup and actually increase in number. I mean, another study presented at the same meeting was that fishing capacity has increased by 54% from 1950 to 2010, which is exactly the reason why we have all these big fish dying out.
You had a good story about mice, and I'm always interested in mice and their abilities to sing and talk and things like that, or maybe talking's going a bit far. But it looks as if there are some scientists doing some work with modifying mice to investigate why people stutter.
Well, I think I was worried you might actually be missing the point of the story if you're focusing on the mouse. But the mouse is just a tool that these scientists in Washington Maryland, the National Institutes of Health have created. So about 1% of the world's population stutters, and about 5% of children develop some sort of stutter, but then they usually most of them grow out of it. And no one really knows what's behind it. Is it genetic? Is it environmental? Is it something cognitive? Who knows? This was an attempt to sort of map out the sort of research that's going on in the area. And Dennis Drainer, who's the chief of a senior scientist at the US National Institute on Deafness and Other Communications Disorders, he was the one looking at the genetics of all of this. And he believes that at least 50% of the reason that someone stutters is genetic. And recently he's identified three genes that are more commonly mutated in people who stutter than those who don't stutter. They don't really know why it's those three genes. There's bound to be scores more. But the usual way any scientist will try and investigate any of this when they find a gene responsible for something is to put that into a mouse model. And so they've put two of these, the most common ones, into a mouse. And mice, as you know, have very wide, interesting vocalizations, but in the ultrasonic sort of range. One day there will be a stuttering mouse there, and we'll play it on this podcast, except that you're going to have to be a mouse to listen to it because it's in ultrasound. I don't know if we can listen to that sort of thing. Talking about sound, actually.
What's fascinating is this is like a case study in what extreme jet lag does to the human mind. I mean, it's like a ramble, a beautiful and an interesting ramble.
I don't know where you're going with that sample, frankly. Talking of sound, now, I did keep one interview back for this podcast, especially.
Can you just introduce yourself and tell me what you do?
Okay, so I'm Bill Chaplin.
He's from the University of Birmingham, not the Alabama one, the one near Wolverhampton here in the UK.
I'm an astroseismologist, so that means that I study the music of the stars.
It's good to go all the way to Washington, D.C. to get that authentic American voice for the podcast, isn't it?
Astroseismology is a word that probably most people haven't heard of. Tell us what it is.
I'm glad he asked that.
Astroseismology is the study of oscillations of stars. These oscillations are the visible manifestation of sound that's trapped in the stars. Stars make sound naturally. The sound is trapped in the stars, and it makes the stars resonate just like a musical instrument. Because stars are big balls of gas, they're not solid objects, the compressions of the sound waves make them gently oscillate. And so that's what we study.
The data you're working with is from the Kepler satellite. And Kepler, famously, is something going out there looking for planets. So how's your work sort of tying in with that?
Okay, so there are strong synergies between the two, in that with our astroseismology, we can measure very accurately the size of the star. And the method that Kepler uses to detect planets, the transit method. From the transit method, you can get the relative size of the planet compared to the star. But if you want to know the absolute size of the planet, you need to know the absolute size of the star. And we can do that with astroseismology. Also with astroseismology, we can tell you how old the star is. So again, if you find a planet, you might want to know how old it is. And just from measuring the properties of the star very accurately, we can tell you whether or not the planet is in the habitable zone of the star or not.
So it adds lots of layers of detail to the description of a planetary system.
Yes, that's right. And also as well, there's a... So it's not just about the synergies with the exoplanet side. There's the huge intrinsic worth into studying stars in general, which are... Stars are building blocks of the universe. And if we want to understand how the galaxy has evolved, measuring, for example, the ages of the oldest stars in the universe, fixing how old the universe is, these are all things that come back to our knowledge of how stars evolve. And Kepler is really revolutionizing our ability to do this.
So if you've recorded these oscillations, I mean, can you make them audible?
Yep, we can. Essentially, what we can do is we can take the measurements. What we actually do when we measure the oscillations is we measure the change in the brightness of the stars that the oscillations produce. And what we can do is we can filter out everything that isn't an oscillation. And what we have left with is then something that looks like a wave. And we can use some software to convert that into what it would sound like if it was a sound wave. We have to speed it up because stars, like the sun, oscillate with frequencies which are well outside the audible range, far too low. So we speed it up and then we can hear what the star would sound like.
What does it sound like? Just describe the noise.
The noise is, it sort of almost sounds like a sort of clicking sound, which is the effect of all the different overtones of the star beating with one another. So a musical instrument usually resonates in perhaps one or two tones. Stars like the sun do so in actually thousands, but for other stars, we can only detect of the order of a few tens of those tones, and that's essentially what we hear. One other thing as well, stars, musical instruments, the different overtones go in direct proportion in frequency. They're harmonic. That's why musical instruments sound nice, whereas the stars aren't quite harmonic. So they're a bit out of tune.
And do different stars have different sounds?
Just like with a musical instrument, the bigger the musical instrument, the deeper the tones. So, for example, a tuba and a piccolo trumpet, the tuba produces tones that are much deeper than a piccolo trumpet, which is a much higher tone. The same is true of stars. So the bigger the star, essentially, the lower the frequency of the resonances it produces.
And so in this sort of orchestra that's going on up there with all the stars, if you were to somehow record everything, could you imagine what kind of noise the entire universe is making with the stars?
Certainly from the stars, as I said, because they don't sound wonderfully pleasing to the ear again.
Maybe not to us.
Yes, a little bit out of tune, yeah.
But maybe to the universe they sound quite harmonic and beautiful.
I mean, it really is the music of the stars that we're doing. I mean, in terms of scientifically, it's beautiful because this provides a way for us to measure the properties of the stars and to peel away their layers and look inside them to do things that we just can't do by conventional astronomy.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
This is Studio Alloc again. Bill later emailed me that file. Here it is. So last week, you got the sound of the sex life of yeast. This week, the sound of stars. If you follow this podcast on Twitter, look for @ScienceWeekly. We'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And for the rest of the Guardian Science content, follow Guardian Science.
Science Weekly, from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jar.
Next, a man who was transformed into a controversial figure when he was sacked by the British government. At the time, in October 2009, Professor David Nutt was chief drugs advisor. To cut a long story short, he and the government disagreed over how drugs policy should be put together. Professor Nutt wanted it based on science. Since then, he's gone on to help form the Independent Scientific Committee on Drugs. He came into The Guardian to tell us about the work of this new committee, including a new way of assessing how harmful drugs actually are.
We use this approach called multi-criteria decision analysis, which is a technology that allows people to really get to grips with areas where there's not definitive knowledge, but use the best knowledge we have in order to come up with the most reasonable interpretations of harm. So we did it in two stages. The first, which I did with the Home Office before I was sacked, was to work out what the harms are of drugs. And if you start from first principles, and look at every possible harm a drug can cause. You come up with 16 separate criteria. And some of these are very obvious, like, does a drug kill you? Does a drug cause illness? Does it make you go mad? And some are also obvious, you know, to what extent does the drug cause economic damage to society? What are the healthcare costs? But also there are some which perhaps people don't think about, like what's the damage to families? Because drug use can often have a huge impact on families for various reasons. And also the international damage. So we took those 16 variables and we took 20 drugs and we scored each drug on those variables using a 100-point scale, where 100 is the worst and naught is not at all. And then you can rank every drug on a ratio against the worst and the least harmful. And that gives you a score for each drug. And that's the first stage. And then the second stage is to say, how do we compare between the different harms? Is a drug causing liver damage more dangerous, more harmful, do we think, to society than a drug which causes family breakup, for instance? So we weighted each of the different 16 parameters and then scaled them. So then you end up getting a score on for each drug, which turned out, you know, in the Lancet paper to show that for the drug harms to the person, of which there are 9 variables, heroin, crack cocaine were the most harmful. But when we looked at society, the harms to other people, alcohol was the most harmful.
This seems like a good opportunity to look back on the whole methadone kind of episode, and, you know, huge number of stories, huge amount of moral outrage about this legal high that then was subsequently banned. What's your sort of take on that whole incident?
Well, my take is very much that it was a fascinating, I suppose what we would call it, sort of sociological historic event. It wasn't very scientific at all. Methadone was banned before we even knew what the pharmacology of the drug was. It was banned on the supposition that it was harmful.
What do we know about it? Very little, is
it? We still know very little. We still haven't studied its pharmacology. We don't know what it does. We do know that a lot of people used it, a lot of people liked it. We do know that in some cases it certainly seemed to produce a crash after they used it. So some people seem to get quite depressed after using it. But whether it was harmful enough to be banned is still uncertain because the analysis hasn't been done appropriately. And what's also fascinating about it is that it may well have reduced harms from the use of other drugs. So surprisingly, last year, deaths from cocaine fell by a half. Why was that? Well, we don't know, but we think it's probably because people switched to methadone. They switched to methadone because it was legal and cocaine's illegal. And also, when you bought methadone then, you knew what you were getting because it was legal. So people were selling it.
They weren't cutting it with other things.
Cutting it, that's right. So people switched for those, you know, people would prefer not to break the law if they take drugs and would prefer to take a drug which they knew wasn't cut. And that may well have saved 40 or 50 lives from cocaine use. So there may have been a benefit, paradoxically, to methadone turning up. Now, what's going to happen next year, we don't know. Now it's been banned, will people stop using it? And will they switch back to cocaine? Will cocaine deaths go up again? We don't know what's going to happen. It's going to be fascinating to watch.
Well, while it was legal, did we have any, you know, decent numbers of the number of people using it? And because presumably when it's legal, it's a bit easier to study those things. And does it become very difficult again to sort of study it now that it's illegal?
Yes, illegality makes it hard to study. We didn't actually take the opportunity to study it much when it was legal because
it all happened rather quickly, didn't it?
Yes, it happened quickly. And of course, it was self-fueling. The more the press and the media got excited by it, the more we think use went up because people started knowing it, learning about it from the media. And so there was a sort of exponential rise, we think, in use, which culminated in claims of death, which in fact weren't. I mean, the Scunthorpe 2 didn't take methadone, and Gabby Price in Brighton didn't take methadone, but it was claimed that they'd taken methadone, and that got people concerned enough to ban it. So it was from my perspective, a very unsatisfactory sort of scientific analysis. So it was, you know, quite, it was a political sort of wave rather than a sort of scientific interrogation. What we've done in the ISCD is we've now, in the light of that, put together what we would call a minimum data set package. So we're going to produce a paper later this spring looking at what we think should be known about a drug before it gets banned. Because some people say, well, it doesn't matter, we just ban everything and then, you know, that won't be an issue. But there are fundamental problems. If you ban everything, you can often get perverse consequences. So people might go to take a more dangerous drug. Banning methadone may paradoxically lead to more cocaine deaths, and we would want to avoid that. If people are going to use illegal drugs, they'd be better off using safer ones and less safe ones. But there's another aspect to it which is not much talked about, but which I find really quite disturbing, and that relates to the follow-up from methadone, which was actually naphthyrone. So there was some claim that naphthyrone was being used as a substitute for methadone. It was hardly being used at all. People didn't like it. It wasn't the same as methadone. But naphthyrone was part of a chemical series which has now been banned. The chemical series was being developed as treatments for addiction. Now that series has been made illegal, people will no longer work in that field. So yeah,
it makes it very difficult to study those things, isn't it? You have to go through all sorts of paperwork and hoops to do
it. It's almost impossible to study drugs once they've been made illegal, for the reasons, as you say, of bureaucracy. But more than that, the government will say, well, we don't stop you studying them. Yes, you can pay us £3,000 a year for a license, and you can have the police come and check your fridge every 3 days. You know, I mean, you can, if you're really concerned or care enough, you can jump through the hoops, but most people don't. But more than that, companies that might want to develop new treatments, you know, pharmaceutical companies, they will not touch an illegal drug. They just won't, because they'll say it's just too much hassle. So now we've banned a drug which wasn't being used, people didn't want to use it, and may have impaired a whole process, a whole seam of research, which could have been very useful.
What do you make of this new government? You know, we've had somewhat concerning news that they were apparently planning to remove the stipulation that you have to have scientists on the Advisory Council on Misuse of Drugs. There's some doubt about exactly what form the ACMD or what role the ACMD will actually play. I mean, are the signs encouraging or discouraging for you?
Well, currently, I'm still have something of an open mind. I have to say, I was very concerned with the idea that scientists might be taken out of the ACMD. I'm not entirely sure what policy is going to be here. I think what they were saying was they didn't want to have certain kinds of scientists like vets and dentists. Personally, I think the vets have been very useful because veterinary practice is very important practice. And I know when I was on the ACMD, there were things we were considering doing which the vets said, well, if you do that, then vets won't be able to treat animals appropriately because they won't be able to comply with the regulation. So it made us think.
And also some drugs like ketamine come from veterinary practice in the first place. Yeah.
That's right. And people don't realise that. There are some drugs which are very important in veterinary practice, which we might say, oh, well, humans don't need them, so we ban them. But that could have a really negative impact on animal health. So I think having veterinary input to decision-making about drugs is very important. So that's the sort of the specific issue about what specialisation should be on the ACMD. And I'd like to see it made very clear that at least those concerns will be met. But the other issue I am quite concerned about is the government's recent strategy paper on drug treatment. I'm concerned that this government has a rather simplistic view about addiction, and that they seem to think that addiction is a lifestyle choice. And it's not. Addiction is an illness. When people are addicted to a drug, it is like them having diabetes or hypertension. Or some people say cancer. In fact, you're more likely to die of heroin addiction than you are to die of many cancers. So these are serious illnesses, and they cannot be dismissed as some government people are saying, well, we'll give you 6 weeks treatment with methadone and then you'll stop being a heroin addict. That's an absurd kind of approach, and it's one that's going to lead to a lot more problems, a lot more social problems as people stop getting treated by methadone and get back in the community, go back to heroin, start committing crime to get their drugs. And it's going to lead to more deaths because street use of drugs is much more dangerous than prescribed use.
Tell us a bit about the sort of international picture. I mean, we've been quite UK-focused in this discussion so far. I mean, around the world, who are doing things well and who are doing things badly?
Well, one thing's for sure, that almost every single country has a different approach to drugs in some way or another, so there's a lot to learn. Countries that do it well, I think, are the Netherlands, where the coffee shop approach with cannabis was actually a revolution. It was conceived as an experiment. They believed that if they separated the cannabis market from the heroin market, they would reduce the number of heroin users, and the young people would go to cannabis and not be offered heroin. And it seems as if they were right. In fact, they have a much lower use of heroin in young people than we have.
It's remarkable how few countries, given the success of the experiment, have actually followed that approach. It suggests that there are some very powerful social lobbies out there that stop it from happening.
Well, absolutely. The Dutch have been vilified for 40 years by the United Nations for taking this approach, because the United Nations, which is largely funded and driven by American drug policy, they've taken the view that cannabis is a really dangerous drug and we should be criminalizing users in order to protect them from harm. So the Dutch have stood up in the face of that. Now, other countries are following suit now, and we clearly see in some of the German states near the Dutch border, they've liberalized cannabis policies, as have Spain and Portugal. It's an experiment which worked, and I personally think we should be using it in this country. I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for regulated use. Look at the American situation. America is completely divided over cannabis. They have enormously punitive approaches to recreational cannabis use. So in California, you could go to prison for life, that's the rest of your life, for your third cannabis possession offense. Now, that has polarized society so much that they've had to now bring in this medicinal cannabis use, because you know, in a way it's been brought in to allow people to have access to cannabis without going to prison. I don't know how to explain it. People have taken an medical view of to deal with what is an absurd policing sort of situation. So now half of Californians have got some illness which they allows them to get medicinal cannabis. And I think the absurdity of that was why behind the Proposition 19, which, you know, surprisingly got a huge amount of support. 46% of Californians voted in favor of legalizing cannabis in the last election. So most people don't want very harsh penalties for drug users because they know it's unfair if you're an addict to treat addiction with criminal sanctions. Locking people up because they're ill is absurd and it's really expensive. So people want another approach, but it's very difficult. Many politicians are scared of actually talking rationally about drugs. They'll do it once they've stepped down. So most senior politicians in most countries will say, well, the drug policy was wrong and now I'm no longer in power. I can tell you that. But
I forget who it was, but there's a Labour minister who did just that.
That's
recently,
right, Bob Ainsworth.
Bob Ainsworth, that's
Bob
right.
Ainsworth, yes. He said, just before Christmas, he said, got it completely wrong when I was drugs minister. We knew what we were saying was untrue. We knew that the harms of drugs weren't as much. We knew it was wrong to pursue those policies, but we didn't have the balls to stand up to some of the media who would have gone for us if we had. So to answer your question, some countries do it right. We've done it reasonably well in terms of treatment. The last government was good on terms of treatment. It wasn't so good on terms of public policy. And I'm just hope that the new government will actually learn the lessons of the old and it won't swing back to a more punitive approach.
Professor David Nutt there speaking to The Guardian's James Randerson. Make sure you subscribe to this podcast so that every programme gets automatically delivered to your MP3 player. The details are at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. That's also where you'll find almost 5 years of our programme archive, all free, of course. Go to guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
A new little section now. Producer Andy has experimentally called it Further Reading. Basically, they're just some bits and bobs from our website that you might be interested in. This week, the Wellcome Trust announced the winners of its 2011 Image Awards. Basically amazing science pictures. So on our website, there's an audio slideshow, a gallery, two videos. Here's a taster.
It's a scanning electron micrograph of the underside of a sticking plaster, so your average plaster that you would put on your finger to cover a cut. And in fact, that's exactly what the creator did. She'd cut her hand. She covered it with a plaster. And being a scientist, she was intrigued as to what it would look like under the microscope. So she imaged it.
Also lurking on the website, we get within inches of a 110.3-carat diamond. It's just gone on display at the Natural History Museum.
You have to take into consideration the value of the item, how it will be shipped here, like armoured vehicle, how it comes into the museum, how we're going to light it, what sort of mount we're going to use.
Obviously all diamonds are valuable, and this is valuable, and one day we'll go to someone that's a collector.
The reason this diamond's yellow is because some of the carbon atoms that make up the diamond structure are replaced by an element called nitrogen. And when you get nitrogen in diamonds, they absorb light in the blue part of the spectrum, and that makes what you see a yellow colour.
There's links to all that stuff on our Facebook group. Search for The Guardian's Science Weekly podcast. Finally, for this section, another experiment. Although we can't really do this under controlled conditions. As you may or may not know, this podcast is now syndicated and goes out on the actual radio in the USA. Hello, listeners, to Remix Radio and PRX Public Radio. However, that seems just a little bit abstract to us sitting here in little old London town. That there are actually people in their cars, homes, and workplaces that find themselves listening to this, basically by accident, you know, not having to download this from the internet, when for a brief moment this podcast escapes, throwing off its shackles and breaking free from the web. So someone, maybe you, is listening right now on satellite, XM channel 136, or on KPBZ 90.3, or I should say KPBZ 90.3, Spokane Public Radio. Anyway, here's the experiment. We want to know if you're listening to us on the radio. Tweet us, email us, hey, even write us a letter. The Twitter address is Science Weekly. Mail us at scienceweeklypodcast, all one word, at gmail.com. Just tell us who you are and what you're doing as you listen to this. We're creating a little snapshot of what's going on all over the States. It sure would make producer Andy's day. That's it for this week. Thanks to David Nutt and James Randerson, also to Ian Sample. Next week...
Hello, Beagle 2! Are you out there?
We have the man who lost a spacecraft. Colin Pillinger will be with us in the studio. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.